nice outside, though. I don't know if you're noticing that, Mr. Chair.
That's right, it is.
I'd like to bring to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency. Committee, we had one bill we carried over from last week or 2009, I can't tell which. And so I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2830. Bob, give us a brief refresher on what House Bill 2830 was.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2830 requires contractor building new residential structure, zero lot line dwelling, to warranty the building envelope and penetration components for 2 years.
Thank you. And up to testify was Scott Marion, John Chandler. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
You'd identify yourselves and give us your supporting testimony.
For the record, that's my note. For the record, Scott Berry on behalf of the Oregon Home Builders Association, and we may get to some somewhat supportive testimony. House Bill 2830 requiring a 2-year warranty on things like workmanship does give us some concerns. Workmanship is undefined in the bill. That certainly concerns us. Today we are one of the most regulated licensed contractor states in the nation. We've got a bond that we post with the Construction Contractors Board, which is in many ways a de facto warranty. We have mandatory liability insurance, one of maybe one or two states with mandatory liability insurance. That liability insurance covers us for the entire 10 years of the statute of repose here in Oregon. So to the extent that somebody does have construction-related issues, files a lawsuit, there's insurance there to back that up. And I think that's important in terms of making sure that that we are covering any concerns that do arise. We have education and testing, not only to become a contractor, but we have continuing education as you continue license in things like building codes and also on the exterior structure of the house, how to keep out rain and water penetration, which have been historically the key factors that have caused problems within the construction industry in Oregon. I will say this, we're not seeing the level of concerns we did in the last probably 10 or 15 years. We had the LP siting issue, which caused a whole lot of problems. That was an unfortunate scenario both for us and for the homeowners as we found a product that really should not have been on the market and heavily used, widely used. We also had the EIFS, the fake stucco product. Similar issues. I know it works well in some states. This is not one of them. And certainly that that issue has come and gone with a number of the issues that were addressed during the Construction Claims Task Force quite a few years ago. The only state, I don't know of any state that has a warranty, a mandatory warranty, other than getting away from what we've got with the Construction Contractors Board and our posted bond for 1 year, in addition to our liability insurance again, and not sure why, but very, very few states require that liability insurance. The only place I'm aware of, and this is where we get around support, the only place I'm aware of that does do a mandatory warranty is Vancouver, British Columbia. I believe they also remove the contractor liability. In other words, the warranty takes care of the defect, period, and there's no downstream liability there for the contractor based on that warranty. And I can find out more information about that for you, but it basically removes the downstream legal liability for construction defect issues, not from other, not from injury or other potential issues, but from construction defect issues. That's my understanding of the way it works down there. For that, the warranty covers and makes sure that the contractor is there or not, that home is fixed. And so that's something we may be able to look at. Maybe not in the real short term. It's probably a longer term discussion, but certainly in the long term. Thank you.
Thanks. I appreciate your input and willingness to continue to look at that. I just, as you know, we were involved in these discussions over the construction contractors claims task force that were aimed at mold and some of the moisture issues that were happening, and perhaps banning EFAS in this state and LP siding is fix those problems and to some degree. But it was always apparent to me that the commercial in construction in Oregon requires a 2-year warranty on the building envelope, and so that was sort of always wondering why residential wouldn't do the same thing, and they didn't reduce their liability or the statute of repose accordingly with the passage of that. So I'm, you know, for me it was just, you know, we can get the a 2-year warranty on the commercial side of construction, and a 2-year warranty on a toaster, and that's always been my issue. Why can't we get a 2-year warranty on the building envelope of a house? Because 1 year later, when you get a leak, you know, it's often difficult for a consumer to say this leak was caused by workmanship or caused by a defect in the product. Anyway, I'm still curious about that, but I would be willing to talk with you more about British Columbia and how that might work in Oregon. But I was just kind of wondering why the industry was so opposed to a 2-year warranty on a building envelope.
Chair Holby, I'd be happy to talk to you about the realities of the commercial warranty and how we might be able to take a look at something that could work. Although I think from our perspective, we needed to find an insurance product that would back that up and back it up in a significant way. We've got products out there that do that our builders offer all the time, things like 210 that do. There are two in a 10-year warranty, but I'm not sure they really get at a lot of the issues that we discussed during the Construction Claims Task Force, and I'm not sure they would solve the problems. I'm not sure that in the end the consumer would be happy with where we ended up by just, you know, pushing it over to existing products that we're aware of that are on the market.
Fair enough. Questions?
So you first used the term workmanship, and then you talked about construction defect. So do you have now a definition that talks about what construction defect is, even though we may not be able to define workmanship, or is either one ill-defined?
Chair Holby, Vice Chair Lively, today it either works itself out through the court system or it is defined through Construction Contractors Board as they go out and with an inspector visit the job site with the homeowner and the contractor and make a judgment on whether there was a defect or an issue there.
Sure. Thank you.
Let's see. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, from your reading of the bill, would this warranty be transferable if there's a sale that occurs within that period of time, this 2-year period that's in view here? It's hard for me to determine.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I don't think it says
okay. The
way I read it. That's one of the concerns we would have if this bill were to move forward, is to address things of a legal nature, such as, is it transferable to a subsequent purchaser? Another thing that the bill doesn't speak to is what responsibility, if any, the homeowner has for maintenance, for not abusing the home, that sort of thing. And as long as I'm speaking, Mr. Chairman, if you don't mind, I do have a couple comments I'd like to make. One, to respond to the question you asked, and I think it's important and you've been through this many times, but for the committee members who are just encountering this issue, we've chosen, with the legislature's help and with the contractor board's help, to focus on the training and education end rather than the legal remedy end in terms of warranty or litigation of any sort. As Mr. Berry indicated, we now have training for contractors entering the industry as a result of the Construction Claims Task Force and the mandatory continuing education requirements. All contractors in Oregon, all 30-some-odd thousand of them, were required to take a 3-hour course on a building envelope shell, best training, they called it. Every contractor had to take that, including a fair number of them who might have been your constituents who called you up belly aching about the fact that they didn't touch the building envelope and therefore still had to take the class. In addition, the Contractors Board has rolled up that same building exterior shell training into the education required for people entering the industry. So all people coming into the contracting industry have to take now a whole bunch of different things, including building exterior shell training. So we're trying to address making sure contractors have the right tools in their hands to do the job properly. We're talking with the Building Codes Division about adding inspections for the building envelope, so we're looking at making sure that where water intrusion points may occur, they're being caught in the inspection side, not afterwards. As Mr. Berry indicated, we do have a there are warranty products on the market, and one of the things we'd want to talk to the chair and others about if this bill decides is to move forward is can we find a product in the insurance realm that will cover the intention of the bill, because leaving it to simply the contractor as a warranty, depending on the financial depth of that individual, that company, may or may not get the consumer very much. We've also been looking at, and this is a relatively new development, our national group, our national group does have construction standards that they are used in evaluating when a claim is meritorious or not, so it addresses such things as cracks in the foundation and when a crack is big enough to be a defect versus just normal wear and tear of the construction process. We're looking now at perhaps offering a book to our members, to customers, to purchasers of the homes that would have that same kind of standards, letting the contractors board work with us on that to see if we can't give some more education and training, not just for the contractor, but also for purchasers of new homes, so they understand what their obligations are. The contractor knows how to do the job better on the front end, and we think, to answer your question, Mr. Chair, that over time will result in fewer claims and have the effect of eliminating the need for a warranty or any specific legal process. Having said that, as Mr. Berry indicated, we're certainly open to the discussion. We want to make sure that our products are not only are well-built and that our customers are happy, because those tend to buy more houses than the customers that are unhappy.
So, and if you would identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association.
Thanks. And I appreciate that. It's just been difficult from my seat to understand why the commercial part of construction in the state of Oregon can offer a two-year, or is required and does offer the two-year building envelope warranty under 701.340. It's very very simple statute that just calls out for a two-year warranty on defect and workmanship. And so anyway, it's something that's already in statute but does not extend to the residential construction. Just trying to understand why there's a difference, that the commercial industry seems to be able to do that with not too much problem finding products to cover their structures, and residential cannot.
Mr. Chair, John Chandler again for the record, I can't speak to whether or not they have insurance products out there. And I think that for us is the biggest concern. And since I've not represented the commercial side of the construction industry, I don't know how they're handling that loss. From our standpoint, since most of our members are fairly small contractors, my advice to them has certainly been, not only with regard to what this bill might do, but the current requirement of a one-year warranty, that they should certainly consider buying an insurance product of some sort to cover their liability, just as a business decision. But I simply don't know if the commercial guys have a product or if they're doing it on their own.
Well, maybe we can talk about it more in the interim.
Yeah, so. Mr. Chair, I would just add that while the commercial folks do have a warranty statute in there, again, we'll get you some more information on the differences between what happens with residential and what happens with commercial. It tends to be more strict on the residential side with regard to the warranty itself and workmanship. Historically, they have not used the Construction Contractors Board and the bond to back that up from a complaint relationship with the consumer, and of course they have a different relationship with the owner of the building than the contractor and the consumer do that purchases the building. It's a bit of a different relationship there, but I'm happy to walk you through that stuff when we have some time.
You bet. Thank you, Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me that while this would be a well-intended idea, the ultimate cost is going to be borne by the guy who's buying the home. I mean, if I'm a contractor, and I'm not, but I say if I were, I would say, okay, so where do I get this kind of coverage? And there'll be somebody out there, you know, you could put it together, you'd say, okay, it's going to cost $1,000 per home, and we're going to have X number of claims, we'll try this out, and so raise the price on the home and by this amount, and then I'll take care of it for you. I'll be your agent. I'll go out every year and check it, you know, after 1 year like the bill requires. But ultimately, the contractor's not just going to eat this. He's got to move on to other things, and so it's just going to be added to the cost of the construction. Now, since it applies to all of these residences, it will not just pick on one over the other. Everybody's prices will go up because there's going to be a cost to provide this kind of coverage. And so while we may say, you know, why not just do this to help people, it will come at a cost, and it will take from individuals the ability to say, you know what, I believe in caveat emptor, I can look at this place, I'll take my own chances, but I'd like to have the value go down on this, you know, save $500 or whatever the cost would be for this, the premium to do this. And so I just think that there could be unintended consequences, and it won't be borne by the contractor. It just becomes a part of the cost of doing business.
Mm-hmm.
And it also applies to those selling a house. So the real estate agents are going to be making sure that they're involved in that decision as well, because it, you know, says that if you build or you sell. So just one of those issues that there will be a cost.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. And I don't know if you would be addressing this question or not, but it's just the language of the bill talks about that the warranty shall provide for the contractor to annually inspect the building envelope, and even after the warranty is rejected, the contractor is supposed to perform these annual inspections, as I understand it. So one, is that true? Two, how would that work? They're private residences, they rejected the warranty, and yet they got this contractor showing up their house, poking around, you know, looking at their house.
Not the intent of what the bill is.
Well, and then third, if the contractor is inspecting his own work, what do you really see happening here?
Looks good to me.
Yeah.
The purpose, this recommendation came out of the Construction Claims Task Force in 2005, I believe, and it was adopted by the commercial industry and is part of our statutes for commercial construction. And this bill was mirroring that requirement. And, you know, we had a lot of testimony over time to people that lost their entire savings by having problems with mold and with water intrusion that were caused by defective products and potentially workmanship that came and testified in front of our committee. It was pretty heartbreaking to see somebody lose $600,000 of their life savings in a brand new home. So, you know, there's the other side of the story, too. So, but notwithstanding, we're not going to move this bill right now, and I'm going to continue to have a conversation with Mr. Chandler and Mr. Berry and see if there's some other route we can go. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2830. Committee, everybody's here. I'd like to go ahead and move a work session on, and open a work session on House Bill 2914. Bob, give us a refresher on what House Bill 2914 was, please.
Jumped up in the beach.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2914 increases the value of money or goods found that must be reported to a county clerk and advertised for reclamation by the owner from $100 to $250.
Thank you. And we have no revenue impact and fiscal impact statement?
There is no fiscal impact, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Lively.
Chair Hovey, I move House Bill 2914 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 2914 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We have discussion on this one.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say that I hope that the Senate, as they look at this, would consider raising that amount. I think going to 250 in today's world is inadequate, and they ought to go to 500 or better, I would think, but certainly I support the bill.
All right. Thank you. And we did debate that with the sponsors and a few other people and decided to keep it at 250 because sometimes $500 is a lot to some people when they lose something. Mm. Other discussion? Hearing none. Samantha, could we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Kinney-Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2914, having received the votes, is passed to the floor. And should we have Mr. Gomberg, Representative Gomberg, carry that bill? With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2914. Let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 2821. Bob, give us information about House Bill 2821, please.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2821 extends the time period in which reasonable and necessary expenses must be covered by personal injury protection benefits. The bill changes damages used in calculating the reimbursement owed to a provider of personal injury protection benefits.
All right. And so we also have another bill on similar subject. I don't know if, but we'll just go ahead and go with this one, and we'll hear the other one next. So up first, I have Tom D'Amore and Neil Jackson. Good afternoon. Mm-hmm. And good afternoon. If you'd identify yourselves for the record before your testimony.
Tom D'Amore.
Neil Jackson.
And was it your intent to also testify on House Bill 2848?
Yes.
Yes.
So I think I'm going to go ahead and if there's no opposition to that, I'm going to open up the public hearing on House Bill 2848 so you can speak to both bills. But let us know which one you're speaking about.
Good afternoon, Chair Holby. I'm going to talk to you about 2821.
Just identify yourself for the record one more time before you speak, so it's clear.
Chair Holby and members of the committee, Tom D'Amore. 2821, I'm here to testify on behalf of that bill for passage. It involves a couple of changes to our PIP statute, personal injury protection, which is the portion of a car insurance policy that pays for medical benefits. It is typically a $15,000 policy, so any medical expenses in excess of $15,000 would no longer be covered by the personal injury protection. So it's not to talk about big medical expenses. The first and probably less controversial part of the bill simply changes the policy period from 1 year to 2 years. So under the old statute, after 1 year and 1 day, your medical expenses would no longer be covered under the personal injury protection. This statute simply extends it to 2 years. So if you have additional treatment within the 2 year period, that's going to be covered. And as I said earlier, the policy limits are typically $15,000, although you can buy more. So even if the person incurs $15,000 of medical expenses during the first year, then obviously they're done and there wouldn't be any additional expenses in the second year. The second part of HB 2821 has to do with reimbursement of PIP to the insurance carrier. So it has nothing to do in terms of changing the policy limits. It's simply reimbursements. And the change that we're requesting is that the injured person, who is obviously most at need after suffering from an injury, either because they're out of work or even if they're back at work, they're treating for their medical expenses, they're most in need. And this change to the statute would allow that person to be reimbursed in full, and therefore the insurance company wouldn't be getting reimbursed their piece unless there was enough coverage to go around. So this statute deals with the situation where there's simply not enough insurance coverage. If the at-fault driver only has $25,000 in coverage and the expenses and non-economic losses exceed that, this statute would allow for the person that's injured to be paid in full. Sometimes if there's enough insurance available, then everybody's going to be paid in full. As the statute stands now, the insurance company or the PIP insurer gets reimbursed first, and sometimes that's out of a very limited recovery for the injured person. So that's 2821. Do you want to speak to that one?
My name is Neil Jackson. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. This bill has been before some of you before in past sessions. One of the things that I want to point out to you is that, and I gave a chart with the written materials, we have 38 states in the United States that have PIP and COAL. Oregon is one of the few that doesn't have it, and our state's law is very restrictive. It's one of the most restrictive in terms of when this money has to be reimbursed to your own carrier. PIP reimbursement, folks, is insurance companies trading dollars. There's no other way you can characterize it, because what happens is, as Tom explained, for example, I have a client right now. We just totaled up her medical bills. It's a pretty serious accident. Her medical bills total $24,668. The driver that hit her has a $25,000 policy. Her PIP has paid $15,000 of her medical bills. She still owes $9,668 to doctors and caregivers for the treatment she received from the accident. Under the present statute, what she will net out of that after she pays her bills and pays her carrier back is, do the math, $330. And she does have some permanent injuries. That's the state of the current law. What we'd like to do is have it so that she is fully compensated, including for her permanent injuries, before her carrier gets to reach out to the other carrier and get full reimbursement. And that's what we're trying to accomplish here. You've got to buy car insurance, and in this state, you have to buy PIP. That's one of the coverages that you must buy by law. You have to buy liability. You have to buy underinsurance and uninsurance. But PIP is one of the elements that you must pay for. The problem, as I see it, is what you're not really buying coverage right now. You're buying a loan because you've got to pay it back. You're paying a premium for that coverage, but you really don't have it under those circumstances. You got to give it back. And it's my suggestion that you ought to get what you pay for. We have to tell our clients when they come before us and they say, here's my situation. Let me tell you, they're not very happy when we tell them, no, I know you paid for PIP, but you don't get to keep it. You've got to give it back to your insurance company. And we'd like to change that. Across the river in Washington, they are a make-whole state. And in 2009, there was a data call done by the insurance carrier, or by the insurance commissioner, asked our carriers to say how much would the premiums increase if we had this law. And four of the carriers said it would have no effect at all. Two of the carriers screaming 25% increase in premiums. The bottom line is the data call revealed that they can't tell us what the effect will be, and yet you will hear them come up and say rates are going to go through the roof. Our rates are comparable to Washington's rates. There's hardly any difference in the premiums that we pay on the side of the river versus what they pay over in Washington. We did our own mini data call in 2009, and we compared six different policies that we could get our hands on in 2 days, compared the rates and the coverages. And we found out that the increased cost for PIP in a make-whole state for these policies was $4 a month. And that's what we found out. It wasn't scientific study, but we had to get it together fast. So the cry that rates are going to go up and there'll be so many more people uninsured is just not credible at all. Finally, again, I go back to what I said before. It's a matter of, are the consumers in this state getting what they pay for? Right now, the current state of the law, they're not. They think they're buying coverage, but they're not. They're buying a loan. And we'd like to say, if they're going to pay premiums, they should get what they pay for.
Thank you. Do we have questions on this bill for this group? Representative Richardson.
Just a quick comment that I was involved in this business for a long time, and what often happened was, in a situation as been described, the attorney ends up calling the medical providers and saying, would you take less than what your charges are because there's not enough money to pay everybody and have the client get anything. Another thing that would happen is they would go to litigation because, although the person who made the mistake and caused the crash thought that they had insurance, they had $25,000, and that insurance would buy them, protect their assets, when the client's going to get nothing, you might as well go to trial and see if you can get a verdict, which, if it goes beyond the insurance limit, then can be a personal judgment against the person that had insurance but just didn't have enough. And so the idea of paying your premiums to buy PIP coverage and then not being able to have that because the insurance companies have this inner insurance arrangement where they one insurance company will reimburse the other directly, a lot of people just don't understand that they've been paying for less than what they really thought they were going to have. So this is kind of a bill that's time is due, in my opinion.
Other comments, questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm confused about how you're characterizing PIP coverage. Are you alleging then or asserting that it should be an open-ended coverage for any and everything that could be attributed to damages that could be sustained? Because that's what I hear.
No.
You're saying that over and above these, you know, prescribed, you know, out-of-pocket, you know, loss of whatever vehicles, I mean, you know, that kind of thing, as it's originally designed. And that's why I think it's a very narrowly tailored type of coverage. But in this day and age, I mean, with all the insurance coverage that supposedly now is available to everyone through our National Health Care Act and so forth and so on, it's hard for me to see a day when someone couldn't find some way to have their coverage provided for and to not to experience, you know, tremendous loss and so forth and so on as you're characterizing. So maybe you can talk about that a little bit, please.
Glad to. Neil Jackson, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Johnson. You will find that let's say, for example, my client had a private health policy, she would also have to reimburse the health policy if they paid any of those bills. This reimbursement is broad-based in terms of what health carriers can do. It is limited. The PIP is limited in the amount because they only have to write $15,000. And so that would be the maximum that had to be paid out by the auto carrier. But they only have to pay for reasonable and necessary medical treatment and services. If there's lost income, the limits on that also have to be $15,000, and they have to pay up to $3,000 a month. It's actually 70% of what the person was earning at their job at the time they got hurt. But the coverages are limited. In the case of PIP Medical, it's limited to the injuries, treatment for the injuries that were sustained in that accident. That's what it's for. So it is limited in that regard. Does that, I'm not sure that answers your question.
Somewhat, but Mr. Chair, I think we'll hear from the industry, obviously, but I guess I'm really concerned about the potential cost increases since this is mandated that everyone has to have PIP coverage. This will affect everybody, a rate increase. And obviously, it's a pretty regressive fee, if you will, for lower income folks who have to provide this sort of coverage on a limited income. They're gonna have to pay the freight for everybody. So I'm concerned, just as a statement, that I'm concerned about the impact across the state of Oregon.
Neil Jackson again, Mr. Chairman. Representative Johnson, if you look at what I suggest you might want to do is take a look at your declaration sheet of your policy.
Sure.
Take a look at how much coverage you have for PIP and how much you pay for that PIP. PIP is incredibly cheap. Seriously, it is really cheap compared to what you pay for liability coverage. That's pretty expensive, and it depends on what kind of car you drive too, of course. But liability coverage is pretty expensive. UM/UIM can be depending on your limits. But PIP coverage itself is, I think you'll see it on your deck sheet, it's one of the cheapest coverages that you buy.
Chair Holby, Representative Johnson, just briefly to add, the reason why it's cheap is because coverages are capped at $15,000 unless you buy more. And in addition, there's a cap in the amount of time that you can get the treatment. 1 year currently, we're proposing 2 years.
Right.
So therefore, since the coverage is cheap, any increases are not going to be very much.
Thank you. Other questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Representative Thatcher.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how many witnesses you're intending to bring up, so I don't know if this is the end of the line. Okay, a few more. Thank you. Why 2 years? Why not 3, 10, 15? Why two?
Chair Holby, Representative Thatcher. I think part of the reason is if you extend it to more years, then there's obviously the price might go up a little bit more. I would say 3-5 years would be good, but that's the limits that have been placed, and we think for the most part 2 years is good because the $15,000 would be eaten up in 2 years period anyway. But in the best world, there would be no limit on the number of years.
Thank you. Other questions? So, you know, just so I'm clear, one of the issues with this is that the $15,000 of coverage, as I'm understanding it, doesn't necessarily go to the person who's been paying premiums for that $15,000. It goes to cover another insurance company's costs.
Neil Jackson again, Mr. Chair. The coverage is a loan. That's the simplest way I can put it, because your own carrier is going to pay up to $15,000 of medical bills that are incurred within a year. Your carrier is then going to look to the at-fault carrier and say, give me back what I paid. So that goes between the companies. Certainly, you get your bills paid for, hopefully in a timely manner, but that's coverage you paid for. It's going back to your carrier when they ask for it from the at-fault carrier.
Okay. Gotcha. All right. Don't see any other questions on this. Do you want to go ahead and testify on 2848?
Yes. Chair Holby, members of the committee, Tom Diamore, asking the committee to vote no on 2848. This change also is requested to the PIP statute, and I think it's a little bit more basic but fundamental. What the bill attempts to do is change one of the fundamental principles of personal injury protection insurance, and that's the public policy reason that when somebody is in a car accident, incurs medical expenses, they want to have comfort that those bills are going to be paid and not denied. And so under the current statute, there's a presumption that the bill for the medical care is reasonable and necessary. The proponents of this bill want to take away or start to erode that presumption of reasonableness and necessity for bills that are submitted more than 60 days after the treatment has been incurred. But the current statute already provides a mechanism for the insurer to object to a bill if they believe it's not reasonable and necessary. Under this scenario, if there's not a presumption of reasonableness and necessity of the medical bill, the insurer could just sit on it and not make a decision as to whether it's reasonable and necessary or whether the bill's been denied. And that leaves the injured victim not knowing whether that bill is in fact going to be paid. So under the current statute, the insurer does have to act. They have to say something. They have to say, hey, we don't believe this bill is reasonable and necessary. And under this proposed legislation, they wouldn't have to do that for bills that are submitted more than 60 days late. And so given that there's already a protection of the insured or injured person and the insurance company, there's no reason to take away that presumption of reasonable necessity, which is in this proposed bill. Therefore, we would ask the committee to vote no on HB 2848.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Neil Jackson, members of the committee, let me give you an example of what this bill could do in real-life situations, because I've spent a few years doing representing people in these kinds of situations. If somebody gets in a really bad accident and gets taken to the hospital and they're unconscious, and so they take them into ER and they do all the stuff and extraordinary measures and they save them, but they're in really bad shape. One of the things that the hospital has to know is, who do we bill? Where do we send the bill for the treatment for this person who got hurt? Well, if the person can't give them their information, number one, a lot of consumers don't even know they have PIP coverage, so they don't know. And if they don't have health coverage, then what happens is, let's say the hospital can't find out who the PIP carrier is under this bill, and they go 60 days and they never find out. The presumption that emergency treatment was reasonable has disappeared. And I've seen that. I've seen where hospitals couldn't get the information, and when they finally got it, it's 90 days later or longer, then they can go ahead and submit the bills. The presumption that emergency room treatment was reasonable is with them. So the consumer is then allowed, if needed, to enforce their right to get the hospital bill paid. If you take away that presumption in that situation, what you've got is a much more difficult time for your consumer, your constituent, to force their own company to pay the bills that they should be paying. It was right after the accident. They went to the hospital, the ER. The consumer can go ahead and enforce it under the present law because there is a presumption in the law that the bill is reasonable. And it might end up in court, it might end up in front of a jury, and the jury would be told there is a presumption that these hospital bills we're here about are reasonable and they were necessarily incurred to treat Mr. So-and-so. This bill takes that presumption away. It's there for a reason. It's there so that there's a motivation for the insurance companies to pay these bills that are related to the injuries sustained in these types of incidents. We really don't want you to take that away because it's an important tool that consumers can use to, once again, get what they pay for. So we'd urge a no vote.
Thank you. Questions on this one? Not seen anything. I appreciate your testimony today, and we'll call up the next panel. We'll be on 2821. Brian Scott, Sean Miller, and Martha Lesmeister. And I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2848, which remains 2821 is still open. And I will reopen 2848, but these people aren't going to testify on that one, so go ahead, please. Introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Brian Scott from American Family Insurance.
Sean Miller, Property Casualty Insurers Association.
And Martha Lesmeister, Professional Insurance Agents of Oregon and Idaho.
And go ahead and start.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Brian Scott. I'm here representing American Family Insurance. I'm the managing attorney for American Family Insurance in its Portland legal office. I've been an Oregon lawyer for about 26, 27 years and been doing insurance-related litigation during that period of time. You've heard some background about PIP and how it works, it's basically a first-party coverage that's available to folks injured in an accident. It provides for $15,000 worth of medical up to $15,000 worth of medical benefits and then wage loss benefits. I'm going to primarily talk about medical benefits because that's really where the change that's proposed by HB 2821 really comes in. Let's take an example. Let's say we have an American Family insured that is injured in a car accident and he incurs $15,000 worth of medical bills. American Family, as his PIP insurer, his personal injury protection insurer, pays those medical bills. And as part of my example, there's a State Farm insurer who's at fault for this accident who has $50,000 worth of liability limits. The treatment goes along. The American Family insured has his treatment paid for by American Family up to the benefit maximum amount of the $15,000. And let's say he recovers completely from his injuries, and the claim proceeds between the two insurance companies. And the way it proceeds is American Family requests that State Farm reimburse its $15,000. If State Farm doesn't agree, by statute, American Family has the ability to file intercompany arbitration and recover from State Farm. And whatever the disagreement is between the two of them, either about the amount of the benefit that was paid or the amount of the bills that were paid, or how the liability picture from the accident shapes, that is, whether the AmFam insured was perhaps partially at fault for the accident, so State Farm gets a discount on what they're going to pay AmFam back, that's resolved in intercompany arbitration. The only limit on that under the present situation is if the AmFam insured, the plaintiff, the injured person's damages, his economic damages, that is, medical bills, wage loss, hard dollar, out-of-pocket kinds of expenses, if those exceed the amount of benefit available, in this case, that would be benefit available would be the liability limits of 50 plus the 15 in medical benefits that was paid under PIP. Then if the value of economic damages claimed exceeds the economic or the benefits available, then AmFam doesn't get its PIP back. It doesn't usually come up The lion's share of these claims are resolved through intercompany arbitration, and the limitation, which is 742.544, rarely comes into play. Now, HB 2821 changes that. It changes it, as you heard from the prior speakers, by extending the medical benefit out to 2 years. Not a huge change. It will increase the amount of payout of benefits. It does increase uncertainty to some degree between the two companies in their intercompany reimbursement efforts. And frankly, again, that probably is not going to come up as often in an acute injury situation where there's a lot of medical bills being spent or a lot of medical expenses being billed in a hurry. That $15,000 in PIP is gone in 2 or 3 days with a stay at Legacy Emanuel in an acute injury situation. So the two-year extension, yes, a little bit more uncertainty and some increased payouts. But where the change in HB 2821 really comes into play is that it limits the PIP insurance company's ability to get its reimbursement from the other side. Instead of keying that reimbursement right to economic damages, which are calculable, it's medical bills, it's wage loss, and some other small items, but out-of-pocket kinds of expenses, easily calculable and easily disputes are easily resolved between the carriers and with the plaintiff's attorney representing the injured party. Instead, the change in 742.544 that's set forth in HB 2821 keys the right to reimbursement of the PIP carrier to the total damages, undefined total damages, just says damages, total damages to the injured person. So how do you figure that out? Let's take that earlier example where you have $15,000 in PIP that was spent by American Family on behalf of its insured. State Farm has its $50,000 policy. Intercompany reimbursement is filed in arbitration, and then State Farm can't come to an agreement with the AmFam insured over what the claim is worth. What are the total damages? Either the plaintiff or the plaintiff's attorney says, my client's claim is worth $70,000. You don't have a right to reimbursement. I get State Farm's 50 and you get nothing. How do you resolve that? Well, this doesn't, the change in 742.544 tells us nothing about how to resolve that. So is there going to be more litigation? Likely. Not between State Farm and AmFam in this setting, but likely between AmFam and its insured. It's going to lead to certainly uncertainty in trying to figure out how this all plays. Responding to a couple of comments from the earlier speakers, part of the reason PIP is relatively cheap is because a lot of it gets paid back. So under the old scheme and the example that I gave you, there should be PIP reimbursement because the total benefits exceed the economic damages, which are easily calculated. Under what's being proposed here in HB 2821, should there be PIP reimbursement? We can't tell. It's unclear. There's no method to resolve it. What happens when you have attorneys on either side of a dispute over insurance? HB 2821 changes a reimbursement system that's worked well for many years. It changes it into an uncertain and a more expensive system that will increase litigation. Please vote no. Thanks very much. Any questions?
We'll listen to the rest of the panel first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Property Casualty Insurers Association in opposition to House Bill 2821. And just a couple quick comments on some of the previous speakers, and I want to talk just about some of the data that came about after the committee looked at this issue in 2009. But, you know, some of the references were of Washington. And, you know, all states are different on this issue. Washington actually doesn't have required PIP coverage. You can actually decline it. You don't have to take it in Washington. There's actually been a trend in a lot of states to actually, because of cost, either getting rid of PIP coverage altogether or, going in the other direction versus expanding PIP coverage. And so, again, the original intent was to, really deal with those immediate out-of-costs, out-of-pocket expenses, medical bills, funeral costs, wage loss, and those issues, and then allow for the subrogation. The issue that you heard from Mr. Scott on dealing with the subrogation issue, we believe it'll virtually eliminate that subrogation ability from the insurance companies. And when the insurance division did look at this in 2009, they did conclude that this could result in a 21.5% average increase in PIP premiums for Oregon drivers. And so we did PCI, the association, also looked at those states, nine different states that currently do not allow the insurers to recover or subrogate, and they do have significantly higher claims severity and loss costs than in Oregon. It was a 64% higher in non-subrogation states than in Oregon, and so the average PIP loss cost per insured vehicle was about 24% higher in those non-subrogation states than in Oregon. So, you know, that I think that data kind of backs up the data from 2009 that we are looking at a potential rate increase. And so I guess just the committee needs to consider, and I think it was along the lines of Representative Johnson's question, you know, it is a required coverage. The actions you do, you make in this committee regarding the PIP will affect all drivers. And so, you know, from, you know, if we are looking at a 21.5% average increase, it's about a $55.6 million rate increase to Oregon drivers. And so that's, again, the data from the Insurance Division 2009 and what we've looked at in other states. So again, you know, we would like the committee to consider that and would ask the committee to oppose House Bill 2821. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martha Lesmeister. I'm an independent insurance agent at Steinhoff Insurance Services in Monmouth, Oregon, and also a member of the Professional Insurance Agents of Oregon in Idaho. As an independent agent, we represent multiple companies, and we find a company that best suits the needs of our client. I'm opposing House Bill 2821 because it would create uncertainty in the claims collection process and, as was presented before, potentially increase rates for my clients and drivers statewide. Monmouth is an independent or a small community, and we hear day-to-day clients having trouble with their insurance premiums, and any increase would obviously affect our lowest income clients who are already having trouble keeping their insurance paid. So it would create a hardship for them. We hear of people losing their jobs and getting their hours cut, and people ask us to try to find them a lower rate, and as an independent agent, we sometimes are, sometimes we aren't, but again, it would just be a matter of trying to keep the insurance costs down for my clients and for drivers in the whole state, and I urge you to vote no on House Bill 2821 to keep insurance affordable.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Kinnegar.
You were saying that this would be really hard to carry out. It would be unclear, and then versus Washington, although it's optional, how is their law any different? And does that uncertainty play out in their system?
I can talk about that. The Washington law is different. It doesn't have PIP reimbursement that's set out clearly or set out at all in its statutory requirements up there. PIP is not mandatory. It's mandatory that it be offered, but not mandatory that it be bought. Mm-hmm. And there isn't any intercompany reimbursement up there where there's an attorney involved. So every time PIP is paid and there's an attorney involved in a tortfeasor lawsuit, the attorney recovers the PIP, takes a third of the recovery, and then reimburses the company if the plaintiff is made whole, which is the made whole piece is analogous to what's being proposed here. So, yes, it's different. We have a pretty clear statute that sets out the reimbursement scheme very clearly.
In Washington?
In Oregon. Oh. Washington has no statutory reimbursement scheme. It's all done through the courts, or there are a couple, three cases that set out what the law is on that, but it's been the subject of a lot of dispute, a lot of litigation between lawyers over the years.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Richardson.
Thank you. I'm a little confused because the prior panel said, you know, there would not be much of an increase, maybe 4%, and said that there was 38 states that have make-whole provisions. We're hearing now it's 21.5% increase on PIP rates, and so I'm confused. And so I would appreciate if we could get in writing from both the just the background on this so that we could kind of compare what's gone on rather than have to go back and forth as far as who said what. But it would be helpful to get information from both panels that would explain whether or not we have this kind of, we should expect a 21% increase in premium, which is really substantial, or is it, you know, a few percent, which is probably not as significant.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Richardson, I apologize. I should have provided that today. I will provide the 2009 study from the insurance division. So what they did is the insurance division actually went out, surveyed a significant portion of the industry, the top carriers, took a lot of their responses, and then distilled it into this report that does come up with these numbers. And so I'll provide that to the entire committee.
Just as a quick follow-up, if there's many other states that have this, I'd be interested in knowing how much they're charging, because it's easy, you know, to come back and say, well, if this were to happen, this is what we would do. But it'd be nice to know whether or not these other states have substantially higher PIP charges than Oregon presently.
I'll provide that too.
Thanks.
Right, and we should get some more data. I think I remember some of the data from 2009, but don't recall a 21.5% report from the insurance division based on the similar bill that was passed last session.
And Mr. Chair, and
or in 2009.
Yeah, and you actually wouldn't have seen it in your committee. What happened is after it passed, there was a question by one of the members on actually getting that data, and then the insurance division followed up, and that data did not even produce until it hit the Senate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, appreciate your testimony.
Yep. Thank you.
And we'll be getting some information from the insurance division, I'm sure.
This makes it sound like you get it.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2821 and reopen hearing on House Bill 2848. And bring up John Powell, Troy Hustleman, and Nan Heim.
Right.
Unless Nan Heim wanted to come up after this panel. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Could
identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Powell, before you representing State Farm Insurance Companies. With me, as the chair pointed out, is Troy Usselman, and I'll let him introduce himself in a minute and describe to you the provisions of House Bill 2848.
Chairman Hovey, members of the committee, my name is Troy Usselman. I work for State Farm Insurance. I have 20 years in the insurance industry. I currently manage a team of PIP claim handlers. Essentially, House Bill 2848, currently in the current system where the statutes are written, bills that are provided to PIP carriers are presumed reasonable and necessary. House Bill 2848 would essentially says that bills that are submitted after the 60-day mark, the providers lose the presumption of the bills being reasonable and necessary. A couple of areas that I wanted to clarify from the earlier speakers, a couple of concerns. One is this wouldn't change our approach to handling bills, nor could it by law, whether the bills were received within 60 days or after. We still would review every bill for reasonable and necessary, whether it's related to the accident. As a matter of fact, the example of a large hospital bill that comes in, those aren't actually the situations that we have in mind with this House bill. Those bills come in, they're reviewed for reasonable necessary, and they're paid. The situations that we're concerned with are situations where bills are held for several months. As a matter of fact, this morning I was reviewing a claim where our insured was injured in a car accident in June of last year, and has been treating with a massage therapist since then, and we're not able to receive any of the bills. And so essentially what that does is it hinders our ability to make that determination whether the bills are reasonable and necessary. Now, from a consumer standpoint, oftentimes we find the injured parties aren't aware the bills are being held. I think that's important to note because they are not privy to the information. If we have a concern about the reasonable and necessary nature of the bills, they don't have that information. Not that it would maybe change their level of medical care, but it's information that we feel like they need to be aware of. I have some information to kind of give you and put in context the amount of bills that we're talking about received over 60 days. And mind you, these are just bills for State Farm. Since 06, we've received $33.9 million in medical bills. And of that amount, $4.5 million were received after the 60-day mark. So it's about 13% of the bills that we receive are after the 60-day mark. Of that, you know, of that list, or of the $4.5 million, hospitals are not in the top five. You've got chiropractors, acupuncture, massage therapy, MRI centers are in the top five, with chiropractors by far and away being the largest amount billed. So with that, I don't, Mr. Powell, you had some information about a proposed amendment?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, again, John Powell representing State Farm Insurance Companies. We have an amendment in drafting that would exempt any billing if the injured party was severely injured and unable to transfer the information about who the carrier is. And so it would delay the 60-day that deals with presumption would not take effect until the person was able to transfer the information to the medical provider. And as Mr. Isselman pointed out, it's very difficult to pay a bill you don't have. And the previous panel said insurers could just sit on these bills. Insurers do not want to sit on bills. They want to know that their insured party is being treated and the extent of that treatment, and to make sure that it is necessary. There is really no excuse for somebody providing soft tissue treatment to wait months to send a billing to an insurer. There's just no justification for it. Again, this bill does not change the law in respects to the PIP carrier's legal liability to pay claims. It simply deals with the presumption as an incentive for these people to be upfront and send their billings in. Most medical providers are very, very eager to get their billings in. They have overhead they need to pay, and they want to be paid. So it's clearly not intended for insurers to get out of legally liable medical costs. It is simply to provide an incentive for providers to bill within 60 days of their providing service.
Questions for Mr. Powell or Mr. Usselman? Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is a presumption, not an exclusion, right? So if after 60 days the bill comes in, it's not presumed to be, you know, reasonable and necessary, but if the facts indicate that it is reasonable and necessary, it still would be subject to being paid. Is that correct?
Vice Chair Richardson, that is correct. It doesn't preclude our obligation under the first party PIP coverage to pay benefits that we owe.
Okay, just a quick follow-up. Has there been any discussion with those that would oppose this bill to try and come up with a amount of time that would be acceptable to both sides? I mean, is 90 days acceptable to everyone? Is 120? I mean, rather than have there be, you know, this is what we want and we're against it.
Chair Holvey and Vice Chair Richardson, the 60 days was chosen because that's the amount of time an insurer has to respond to the billing. So it was decided that would be the fairest way, 60 days to get it in after treatment, and after receiving, the insurer has 60 days to pay. The 60-day period is for due diligence to, if in fact there is reason to suspect that treatment was provided that wasn't medically necessary, that sort of thing. It's usually not taken, but it we just chose that as a fair give and take.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Thatcher.
Yeah, what, are you aware of what other states might do in this regard?
Chair Holby, Representative Thatcher, I am not aware of how other states are handling this particular area. But I did want to say that, you know, from a consumer standpoint, the other concern would be if, you know, as previously mentioned, 15,000 is the most common PIP limits that we have in Oregon. You can purchase higher than that, but 15,000 is most common. If your provider is not billing the insurance company to be reimbursed, you're likely to be unaware that your benefits are being exhausted quicker than you realized, and you don't have the opportunity to switch care if that's what you choose to do. But to answer your question, Representative Thatcher, I'm not aware of what other states, how they're handling that.
So, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I think, from my perspective, what's being proposed here would seem to be in line with or in keeping with some of the insurance, if you will, medical reforms that we've been involved in here as a state and trying to ensure that there's greater communication about how treatment is actually being administered and whether that's necessary, timely, or the redundancies and that sort of thing. So, I mean, through the whole CCO network, we're trying to ensure that providers are communicating more regularly so that costs don't unnecessarily escalate, that we can keep a handle on what's going on to make sure that treatment's necessary is provided, but not unnecessary treatments and so forth. So that's what I'm hearing in this. So I guess I don't know if you guys have any comments about that or from the CCO perspective, if you've had been a part of any of those discussions or not. But.
Yeah, Chair Holby, members of the committee, I completely agree. Representative Johnson, I'm sorry. I completely agree with that viewpoint. Mr. Pell mentioned earlier that we are looking to be proactively paying bills that come in, and the information, the documentation needed to support the bills and whether or not it's reasonable and necessary are integral part of handling claims. And without that information, it makes it really difficult for us to administer that. So the intent of this House bill definitely is to get that information, to improve the communication with providers and PIP carriers, and get the benefits, get that situation settled quicker than later, for sure.
Thank you. So what would it take to overturn a presumption that they were reasonable and necessary? What would a consumer have to do?
Chair Hall, I'm not sure if I understand the question. Can you rephrase that?
Well, if the presumption is that they're reasonable and necessary within 60 days, and you go beyond 60 days, how does someone prove otherwise that they actually were reasonable?
Okay, Chair Holby, thank you for the question. As I mentioned earlier, our approach to claim handling wouldn't change if the bills came in after 60 days. What we find is we will receive $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 worth of bills all at the same time, so we call it bulk billing. It puts a burden on us. We all have to go through all those bills and the chart notes to determine whether it's reasonable and necessary, and oftentimes, because a high percentage of those instances, we have providers that are amongst the top in the state for billing per patient already. We have concerns whether or not they're reasonable and necessary. We need to get oftentimes peer reviews or utilization reviews or an independent opinion as to whether or not the bills are reasonable and necessary. Well, that takes some time to get through. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Other questions? Representative Thatcher.
So along that line, so if you decide that it is not reasonable and necessary, what would the consumer have to do? Is there a process to say, hey, no, it really was reasonable and necessary? What would that process be?
Chair Holby and Representative Thatcher, Yes, there is a clause. I can speak for the State Farm policy. There's a alternative dispute resolution clause, which essentially provides for an avenue for dispute resolution. If the injured party disagrees with our decision, they can ask for arbitration. So the claim would be presented in front of a neutral arbitrator to make a decision, or they can obviously pursue litigation if they choose to do so.
Oh, Representative Doherty.
I have a follow-up question to that. Who pays for the arbitration and the litigation?
Chair Holvey, Representative Doherty. The insurance company pays I'll speak for State Farm again, all but $100 of the arbitration fees. Okay. So the injured party pays $100 and State Farm pays the rest.
Okay. And then litigation's on the patient.
I'm sorry?
Litigation, if they have to go to litigation on this, on the fee, it's on the patient.
The litigation fees, if it does go to litigation and it is determined by mandatory arbitration or trial that the insurance company needs to pay additional benefits, then the insurance company is exposed to attorney fees by the injured party. They'll have to pay those.
Thank you very much.
What about in the reverse situation where the insurance company is found correct and the consumer is found incorrect? Who pays in that situation?
Chair Holvey, the insurance company does not get reimbursed for their legal fees in that process, and nor do they owe the legal fees for the injured party.
Other questions? Representative Lively.
I'm just trying to understand. So currently it's 1 year. You're asking to change it to 60 days, but I'm trying to understand the motivation. I'm trying to understand, so if we cut it off at 60 days, and I appreciate whether it's reasonable, you know, that I've been through those discussions, whether it is or not, and I understand that process. But I guess I'm trying to understand, so who's this pointed at, and what are we trying to get at by changing the date?
Yeah, Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Lively, I think we may have the two House bills. Look, House Bill 2821 proposes an extension of the PIP statute from 1 to 2 years. House Bill 2848, which is one we've been speaking of, essentially what it does is if providers send the bills in after 60 days from providing the service, they lose the presumption that those bills are considered reasonable and necessary. So it doesn't affect the statute.
So in that situation, who does the provider then turn to for their payment if the insurance company says these aren't reasonable and doesn't pay?
Chair Holvey, John Powell again for State Farm Insurance Companies. The basic statute of PIP liability on the carrier does not change. They would still have, it would still be on them, the insurance carrier, to note exactly why the billings were not medically necessary. It just changes that the presumption that the day the insurance company receives it, unless they deny the claim, they're presumed to be medically necessary and reasonable. So it does not change that standard. It simply means that they lose that presumption. The carrier's still on this claim for 1 year, and medically necessary and reasonable billings still must be paid under the statute, even as it would be amended.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Richardson.
While that may be the case, is there not a change in the burden? In other words, if State Farm, for instance, were to say, after 60 days, our position is if it's from a chiropractor, a massage therapist, or acupuncturist, it's not related. Okay, there's no presumption, and so now it's on an injured person to come forward and either arbitrate or whatever, and attorneys aren't going to do that for free. I mean, it's just a hassle because you're not talking about a lot of money anyway when you're talking about PIP benefits, but does it not put a large burden on the individual, many unsophisticated people, to have to try and prove State Farm wrong in their failure to pay the bill? And they got to come forward with their witnesses. State Farm can have an independent review. Those are not exactly independent, but they are certainly reviews, and they come forward and they say, okay, you know, none of these are reasonable, necessary, because this person went to a chiropractor 5 years ago, and therefore they're just getting treatment for something that they hadn't had treatment for. So now there is this position and it's now back to the insured to have to prove that their insurance company should have paid it, or else the insured's not going to get the benefit of the coverage that they paid for by paying premiums. Is that not the case?
Chair Hovely, Representative Richardson, no. The burden would still not be shifted. The insurer is still liable for medically necessary and reasonable expenses as a result of the accident. In the example you gave of 5 years ago, somebody was being treated for a certain injury, and it appeared that this that injury was the cause and not the accident. That same process would take place if the bill was received within 60 days, if they knew about the previous treatment. So that does not change. The claim would be handled, as Mr. Erlesman pointed out, the same if they get them batched or bulked in 8 months, or whether they get them as the treatment is being provided. The difference is this is simply an incentive for a provider to get their billings in within that 60-day period. It does not change the weight of who has to pay this claim and or prove that the person's injury or treatment was the result of something else.
Just for clarification, sir, I know we need to go ahead.
Go ahead. Clarify for me.
Presumption is just that. It's presumed that these are reasonable and customary or necessary unless the insurance company could show that there's reason to believe it's not. And then if they got a mistake, there's other channels, but it's pretty hard for the insured to follow up on those. If there's not a presumption, I guess we're not real clear on what difference that makes. And we understand they should send in their bills. They shouldn't wait to the very end. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult because if there's PIP is gone, or if the if there's a challenge and you've got a $10,000 bill, ultimately the insured is going to get stuck with that, and or some portion of it. And so the idea of billing makes sense, but we're not clear on how the term presumption changes if it's really going to be handled the same by the underwriters or the adjusters.
Chair Holmes, Vice Chair Richardson, to answer your question, to reiterate what Mr. Powell said, we are committed to paying the bills on a reasonable necessary basis. Obviously, the intent of this House bill, it was to correct the billing behavior of what ends up being a relatively small percentage of the providers in Oregon, but the amount of bills that come in from these providers end up being a significant amount. So okay. Internally, nothing would change on how we handle the bills as they come in.
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Heim, would you like to give your testimony, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nan Heim, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Ambulance Association. Our members are their fire departments and private companies that are the designated 911 emergency ambulance service providers in their communities. Their concern about this bill is very simple. They, more often than not, cannot bill within the 60 days because they don't have the insurance information. I think it goes to the communication that was mentioned earlier. If you think about the emergency ambulance responds to the traffic accident, treats and transports the victims, but does not get the insurance information. They have to get it later from the hospital, and that they tell me that more often than not, they bill later than 60 days. It's interesting that we're not part of the list there because I think we're such a small part of the claims. But they don't want to lose the presumption that they're reasonable and necessary. And I have talked to Mr. Powell and his clients about this, and they're willing to consider an amendment for ambulances should the bill move. Thank you.
So thank you. And other questions for this panel? I certainly do say that this is a little bit confusing, and why somebody who would be a provider like the ambulances can get an exemption as to being reasonable and necessary
after day 61, where at day 62 somebody else is not. And, you know, it still is I'm missing something there. So maybe I'll have a conversation with Representative Richardson after the committee, and maybe he can clarify that for me. So I appreciate your testimony today. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2848. And I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2824, and I'm going to concurrently open House Bill 3159. These bills are relating to towing, and Bob, why don't you give us a little information about these two bills?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2824 clarifies that tower may tow a motor vehicle that violates prominently posted no parking sign that warns that parking is prohibited 24 hours a day, or a vehicle that parks next to a red or yellow curb. House Bill 3159 limits the charge for towing motor vehicle without prior consent and authorization of the owner or operator to an amount set by the Oregon Transportation Commission. The bill directs the commission to establish rates for towing and related services and sets maximum rates.
Thank you. And I did forget to announce we are not going to hear House Bill 2932 today. So up first on House Bill 2824, we have Sandy Polishuk and Sybil Hebb. And so we're open under both bills, so if you want to talk about one first and then the other one, that'd be fine.
Okay. Do I go first?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
I'm Sandy Polishuk. I live in Portland. I thank you very much for hearing my testimony today. I'm here as a citizen and a consumer, mostly a consumer. In most consumer transactions, if the consumer sees something as being goods or services being overpriced, they have a choice to say no. This is outrageous. I'm not going to do it. They can go somewhere else, or they can forego the service. But sometimes we don't have a choice. I doubt that anyone, my imagination doesn't stretch far enough to see when anyone would choose to have their car impounded. Once that happens, you are at the tow company's mercy. They have a very valuable possession of yours, and they're not going to give it back until you pay. And in many places, you pay whatever they ask. Two and a half years ago, I was towed in Beaverton. I won't go into the details of why I was towed. It was the first time in my life I ever had. I parked somewhere with no signage, no painting on the curb, but it was a private street, and I was towed. They towed me 0.65 miles, and they had my car for an hour and a half. My bill was $320. I have my bill with me, and I will leave it with you. It's been 2.5 years. It's faded a little, but you can still read it. They charged me $140 to hook up. They charged me $5 a mile, and they said it was 2 miles, even though it was only 0.65, and they regularly patrol this place, so I doubt they actually had to come over for me. They charged me $50 for a dolly because I had locked my car with the parking brake on, something I would presume most of us do. They charged me $20 to take digital photos. In other words, to go like that. They did not have to print these photos, $20. They charged me $20 for dispatch, which I don't really think they had to. They were dispatched, but I can't prove that.
They charged me $40 as a gate fee. That's turning a key in a padlock. That kept the cyclone fence closed. They charged me $40 storage. It was an hour and a half. They have a 24-hour minimum. I don't even know of the most exclusive five-star hotel that charges $40 to store your car for a day or an hour and a half, for a grand total of $320. I found that outrageous. But there was something I could do. I was at their mercy. They had my car. I have a pretty nice car. People who don't have very nice cars probably have to walk away from them at that point. In either case, I think it's a situation where the consumer has no choice. It is very similar to utilities, and we all know we regulate utility charges. And I think that it is imperative that the consumer be protected here and there be regulation for this. And at this time, I was told only two cities, I believe Portland and Corvallis, have any price regulation on towing. And I think it's imperative that you protect the consumer from these companies that operate in what is truly a predatory manner. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, Vice Chairs Lively and Richardson, members of the committee, my name is Sybil Hebb. I'm an attorney with the Oregon Law Center, which is a civil legal services provider. We're testifying today in support of these bills. I have just a couple of comments to add. Our clients are low-income communities of Oregon. Our clients make 185% or below of the federal poverty level. And these are families that are struggling greatly to make ends meet and to go about their business. Their cars, when they are lucky enough to have one, are an important part of their ability to get to work, to take their children to child care. Some places, unfortunately, sometimes their cars are where they are where they live. And so we don't dispute that tow companies provide an important public service, and they're entitled to charge reasonable costs and fees for their service. And we appreciate that, but we think that the burden on, especially on low-income populations, when they are struggling to try to remedy a mistake that they may have made that resulted in their car being towed, we want to make sure that there's not such a huge barrier to them in accessing that their property that they're virtually unable to ever have hope of succeeding in getting that back. So we think it's appropriate for the state to play a role in regulating what those costs are and in making sure that the cost structure is fair and reasonable. So we appreciate the effort of Senate Bill, of House Bill 3159 in imposing that kind of a structure. Since the bills are both open, I'll just make a couple of comments also on House Bill 2824 with the Chair's permission. I think if I understand House Bill 2824 accurately, it is adding an element that would allow a tower, a patrol tower, to tow a car from a property without notice in advance to the owner of the property. I appreciate the rewording that is accomplished by 3 sub D. The 3E addition of parking next to a red or a yellow curb, I understand the concept and agree with the concept. It seems that most people understand that a red or yellow curb is meant to prohibit parking. But I would respectfully ask that it would be maybe clarified a little bit. Next to is a little bit unclear. I don't know if we know exactly what that means. If you're parking in front of or along a curb that is clearly marked as red or yellow and is identifiable as a no parking, then we would agree with that addition. So that would just be my suggestion there. Thank you very much for your attention to this. Unfortunately, towing practices have a major impact on our clients' lives, and so we appreciate your look at this. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Yeah, I understand the argument on sort of a monopoly thing that you're kind of referring to, but I'm just wondering, since it sounds like communities can go ahead and regulate towing prices, why state policy? Because it seems like it would be different. There would be different economic factors coming into play in different communities.
Chair Holvey, Representative Thatcher, members of the committee, I don't disagree that there are different circumstances in different communities and don't object to that concept. It feels important to me that there is a state role in making sure that there is something that exists throughout the state that's sort of a floor of protection. If communities wanted to do individual, you know, different structures within their own governments, that would seem perfectly reasonable to me.
Which follow-up?
Representative Thatcher, as a citizen, I don't only park my car in my community where I have any political power to change the laws in that community. So I was visiting Beaverton when this happened to me, and I have no way to influence Beaverton law. So I would like to see wherever I have my car that it's regulated.
I understand. A follow-up? Cool. I guess what I was meaning is that, for instance, land and stowing a car or storing a car might be a little more expensive in some parts of the state than others, and therefore there might be a range. And I'm wondering also if there are, well, if you're aware of, one's my favorite question, if any other states do this.
Yes, they do. California does, and Washington had a bill that almost passed last year in February, but was killed by the tow truck lobby. But California does, and there are many. That I got this from my senator who worked on this bill in the Senate, that there are maximum fees in many states, but I don't know exactly.
And Representative Holvey, Representative Thatcher, I'd be happy to look into that and to provide you with some information in answer to your question. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for this panel?
Just a quick one. I think that Representative Thatcher has brought up a good point, and that is, why would the state need to preempt communities? And so would it not make sense to say that in the event that a local community has not established a set amount, then it shall be this? Because otherwise we're saying the state from now on will preempt cities and counties in something that they've been handling already on their own.
Yes, I think you might be taking somebody's testimony away, but good point. Representative Doherty.
I don't know if it was in this part of it. I got the impression from some of the written testimony on here, that there are only two cities that have any sort, and that was Corvallis and Portland.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I was right on that one.
That's what I understand as well.
Okay, thank you.
So thank you very much, and I hope you're not giving us that bill in an expectation that we're going to pay it.
Unfortunately, I couldn't walk out of there with my car without paying.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot.
Go rescue your car right now.
So I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2824. House Bill 3159 is still open, and we have Elkins, Wagner, and McClellan. Sounds like a law firm.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Tow Truck Association. With me today is Mr. Mike Wagner from Lyons, Oregon, Sandyham Enterprises, past chairman of the association. And to his right is Gary McClellan from Eugene, who is the current president of the Oregon Tow Truck Association. And we have some observations about House Bill 3159 that Mike will share with the committee.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, my name is Mike Wagner. I own actually two companies, Sandyham Towing, which is a towing firm up in Lyons that covers the Sandyham Pass, and a company called Sandyham Enterprises that builds and sells tow trucks. So I'm kind of I do a variety of things. I certainly understand what 3159 is attempting to do. Unfortunately, I, like many of the attempts to solve the problem that's been described, the one-size-all approach doesn't seem to really work or fit. The bill is written in language that's pretty broad, and so although it was intended, I believe, to just cover PPI towing, and I would hope that, I guess maybe I should explain what PPI towing is, but PPI towing is personal property impound. That is the when someone typically parks where it's prohibited, the property owner would hire or contract with a tow company to have the vehicle removed so that to preserve the property rights of the individual that owns the property. It could almost be a land use issue. We typically are, there's more cars that need to be parked in many places than there is parking spaces available to accept those cars. And so it creates a shortage of parking spaces that could lead to problems. The language being broad that I referred to, it's broad enough that it will cover all police towing. Police towing is a little different than PPI towing. Most of the police towing is involved in auto accidents. So when you're involved in an automobile accident, there's labor at the scene involved in cleanup and maybe a winching or a rollover, some type of labor that's in addition to the standard things we've heard referred also. We've heard already of hookups and possibly dollies or flatbeds and mileage charges. Some people charge dispatch fees. Those were all on the bill that we saw, their storage. To try and put a one-size-fits-all limit on this type of towing is very difficult to do. My company covers from Hoodoo Ski Bowl down to the Salem city limits. We have three locations. So it's not uncommon for us to handle a motor vehicle accident up near Hoodoo, and that vehicle would be towed to one of our yards, either in Lyons or State, a distance of 60 or 70 miles. So the $200 that's proposed here doesn't go very far as we cover that or even cover the events that lead to getting on the road. So there's just some flaws there in the way it's written. It asks for a mechanism to enforce the law that doesn't exist. There isn't anyone at DOT or DMV, which is how I interpret the Department of Transportation, has the ability or sets rates currently for any transportation industries that I'm aware of. So there would have to be a mechanism put in to create this bureaucracy to enforce this. It's not there. We spent a great deal of time in 2007 and 2009 revamping the laws that typically enforce or regarding PPI towing. The flaw there, I think there was some good thought and some good effort that went into that. The flaw is that there's, once again, nobody to enforce the things that were changed back then. I believe if there was enforcement of the current regulations, that it would solve some of the problems. It would seem to me that many times if a company is providing bills that seem a little bit out of the ordinary, I'm guessing that they may not be following all the rules that are associated with what they're supposed to do when they perform that service. But, I do agree that this is best left to local and county control. It's the police towing is regulated at many levels statewide. Many counties and cities do that. It hasn't. The PPI towing has only been. Sounds like I'm aware that Portland has regulations on PPI towing. I wasn't aware that Corvallis did, but that's possible that they do. For whatever reason, that portion of it has not been enforced to the degree that the police towing has. There has been a lot of administration concerning police towing. One of the other things that really isn't addressed here is different sizes of vehicle have different cost structures associated with it. Once again, the one-size-fits-all thing doesn't work very well. One of our past president of the association, immediate past president of the association, is out of Albany, and he called yesterday and said, okay, what happens when I have to impound the semi from the truck stop? And he said, I do that about once or twice, maybe once every month or two. And he said, it's safe. Somebody will abandon a semi or park it in the wrong place for a long period of time, and somebody needs it out of there. And so that doesn't happen very often, but once again, it's another thing that does happen that it's a different $200 won't get us very far in moving that 18-wheeler, which may or may not be loaded. So I think that's the what I was trying to articulate, and I'm certainly open for questions if anyone would like to ask any. So.
Thank you. And if Mr. Wagner?
Yes.
That's you. Okay. How about Mr. McClellan next then?
Good afternoon, Chair Holby and
members of the committee. I'm Gary McClellan with Ray's Towing in Eugene, Oregon, current president of the Oregon Tow Truck Association. One thing that Mike did not mention is that neither Sandy Am Towing or Ray's Towing, we do not do private property impounds. There is a need for it. As he stated, it could almost be a land use problem, more cars and parking spaces. However, with that said, this bill, in my opinion, is written too broad and would encroach upon the agency towing, which could either be a police department, a fire department, it can be the Department of Forestry, and the ODOT. When we go out on those calls, typically they're accident tows, and they may require additional men and equipment and more hours, man hours to complete the job. And of course, the $200 is probably not sufficient for that. It also states up to 20 miles. The average price in the state, I believe, is about $5 per mile for towing. So if it was 20 miles away, you would utilize half of that cap already. It would allow us to do a competent job of cleaning the roadway and making the roads safe. And I guess that's what I have. I'm open for questions.
Thank you. Questions from Representative Thatcher?
As I asked the last panel, apparently local jurisdictions do have the ability to set pricing, I guess. Referring to that, would you rather have a proliferation of patchwork or one policy?
Well, Representative Thatcher and Chair Holby and the committee, I'd take a shot at that, if you will. I think that the when you look at Oregon, the needs of the different areas are so diverse that it's very difficult to have you do anything at the state level. I believe that would be effective here. I think the tower that's, well, myself working in Sandy Am Pass, a guy working out of Ontario, Oregon, La Grande, Oregon, the needs are going to be much different than someone who's in the Portland metro area doing work. And I do believe that the control is best left to the local level. We've seen it. We've seen that a lot in the police towing arena, where there is a plethora of contracts that have come up at the city and the county level. The Oregon State Police has a system. It's an open rotation system, and they have not, as of yet, went to any kind of a contract. But we've seen it a lot at the county and the city level. I believe that the majority of the PPIs that are being done in the state of Oregon are probably, they're concentrated largely in the Portland metro area, I believe. And I think they would follow the I-5 corridor. You have a couple of more bigger communities, probably Eugene, Salem, Eugene, and Medford, I would guess, would be the next, you know, to follow. But in the smaller towns, I don't think you have the same, you don't have the compaction and the you know, the need maybe for the service. And I know that I'm certainly very concerned as a residing in a small town. I'm very concerned about, I live with all these people, you know, and I rub shoulders with them all the time, and I don't need to be doing things that further irritate my neighbors. I try real hard not to do that. Small town, and I'm grateful for whatever business I get, and I try to encourage that business. So.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony on this. I know we have some issues around towing that seem to keep resurfacing, and we'll talk about this more. I want to get the next testifier as we're running out of time.
Okay.
So I appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you.
Up next, I have Dan Eisenbeis. I just butchered his name. Marion Gaylord.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Dan Eisenbeis with the City of Portland. With me here today is Marion Gaylord, the city's towing coordinator. Want to thank you for your consideration of House Bill 3159 and considering baseline regulation of tow-in prices in Oregon, particularly in areas where local communities have not provided regulation of tow-in prices. The City of Portland has chosen to regulate involuntary towing of vehicles on a more comprehensive basis, and we feel like that is something that has provided meaningful protections for folks within the City of Portland. Our request to you would be to amend the bill with a clarification that communities may continue to regulate prices at the local level, such as the City of Portland has done. Ms. Gaylord can speak more to the City's approach to regulation, but what we've suggested in the written testimony before you is really just a clarification of an existing non-preemption clause that is in statute. We feel that the bill as it's introduced would create some ambiguity as to whether cities have the continued authority to regulate prices.
Thank you. And if you could summarize what you have to say in just a few short minutes, that would be helpful.
That's difficult when you talk about towing.
I bet.
Marion Gaylord, City of Portland Towing Coordinator. To try to sum this up in as few words as possible, the city began regulating private property impound towing in 1988, but for the next 15 years or so, what we found was very frustrating. It was very, very difficult to provide the kind of assistance to the citizens and protections for them, while at the same time addressing the fact that these are private property owners who choose to restrict parking on their property. So in 2003, we did a very comprehensive rewrite, and including a number of things to assist us in investigating complaints, to better keep records of these tows, to require the towers to take photographs to be able to demonstrate that there was a violation in some sense that caused the tow. And it goes on from there. We also, a large part of this was establishing citizens' rights. We require that every tower post in their release office a list of rights that every citizen has the right to, including information about how to contact the city to file a complaint. Part and parcel of that was also the regulation of the rates. And we went through 2 years of audit activity and investigation of other jurisdictions across the country. And what I found out is that none of the other cities that I contacted were actually regulating this at all. And I don't know if it is as prevalent in all the other cities, but it certainly is a big business in Portland. Then in 2007, 2007 and 2009, I worked with the Department of Justice committees that were fine-tuning the ORS statutes on this, specifically because they admired the code changes that we had made and were interested in how that has impacted towing and the citizens.
And if I could get you just to wrap up, this bill will come back for a little bit more testimony, and I would like to find out a little bit more about Portland's regulations, and certainly I don't think it's the intent of our bill to preempt local governments from their regulations. So your amendment would, at least from my seat, would probably be a friendly one. So.
And Chair Holvey, members of the committee, just an important note, part of our reasoning for the request for the amendment is part of our rate regulation includes a modest fee on the involuntary towing. And what that does is it helps fund the towing program, including a process for investigating and resolving complaints. And if there is a valid complaint and after investigation, then the person who was towed can have their charges potentially refunded, including those fees. But we feel like that helps enable this more comprehensive framework at the local level.
So do your rates just apply to the involuntary towing?
The rates that we're discussing here apply only to private property impound, and that is, of course, involuntary towing.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate you coming forward and giving this testimony, and I think we're going to have to wade through a little bit more of it in the coming days. And so we may be trying to have another conversation with you at some point, through Dan probably, if necessary. So thank you so much for giving us the final testimony of the day. And committee, we have run out of time, and I will close the public hearing on, which bill is this? 3159. And adjourn the, I'm going to carry over House Bill 3159 and House Bill 2824. And with that, we'll adjourn the House Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency Committee. I'll deal with that one.